Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, starting with the All-Star game last night. I mean, the Pro Bowl, as an example, comes up every single year. Every single year we have the Pro Bowl. And every single year, somehow it manages to get even worse than the year before. And every time I see the Pro Bowl, I am reminded that really, it's not just a Pro Bowl thing, it's an All-Star game thing. Like, no All-Star game is actually any good, except for the MLB All-Star game. Or at least at one point, it was. I mean, hell, at one point, the American League and the National League actually hated each other's guts. At one point, they wanted to beat the hell out of each other. At one point, that game felt more like a postseason game than it did a regular season game. Or an exhibition game, for that matter. It just did. I mean, that game used to have serious juice. And it was in this lifetime. Yeah, like, I know Pete Rose ain't coming through that door, much less to run Ray Fosse into the dugout and wreck his career. But that was the one All-Star game in any sport that used to truly kick ass. And the powers that be know this. Why do you think they've jacked with that game as much as they have over the years? Because they're trying to make it matter once again. They're trying to get us to care about that game once again. More importantly, Major League Baseball is trying to get the guys who play in the game to care about that game once again. Except last night, despite all their efforts, it really didn't help, did it? Like, I really am trying to have a good attitude about what I saw last night. I'm not here to hate. I love baseball. I don't hate baseball. I'm trying to have a good attitude about what I saw, except I'm failing. I mean, there were a couple of moments. And I will get to one of them a little bit later on. But that's all there were. A couple of moments and a whole lot of boring. And time that I'll never get back that I lost. I mean, remember the night before, Vlad Jr. hit 91 home runs. The guy hit 91 home runs the night before in the Derby. The ball is leaving the yard faster and further than ever before in baseball this season. So where the hell was all that last night? That's what we all tuned in to see. Last night. Instead, it devolved into a pitcher's duel between like 50 pitchers. The Royal Rumble of pitching. The National League managed all of 5 hits, 16 strikeouts. There were a total of 13 hits, 23 strikeouts. Couldn't have been more boring. American League 4, National League 3, everybody watching 0. Brutal. Now, normally at this point, I'm going to play you a bunch of highlights. But there really weren't any. There was only one set of highlights, and I'll get to that in a minute. And no, I am not interested in how many times in a row the American League has won. Nobody is. Not even the American League. I know the National League isn't, or it wouldn't keep happening. Do you really think that NL players went back into the clubhouse last night and smashed up a bunch of Gatorade jugs because they lost? Of course not. Why would they? They know it's a meaningless game, and last night had all the feel of a meaningless game. But if it's going to be meaningless, at least give us something. Give us some action. Anything. Like, that game was about as exciting as Commissioner Rob Manfred trying to spin that they don't know what's happened to the baseballs. Even better was him saying that Major League Baseball teams do not actually want more home runs. He said that. The commissioner said that. I mean, how rich is that? Manfred trying to spin that home runs suck. And if anything, teams want less of them. You know, because no fan's going to pay top dollar to see the best of the best hit it off the scoreboard. Nobody wants that. Oh, all right, commissioner. Yeah, teams don't want more home runs. Like, I don't want better callers to this show. You don't want more home runs, Robert. Like Roger Goodell, Adam Silver, and Gary Bettman don't want more scoring in their respective leagues. Hey, Bobbo, what are you going to tell me next, Rob? That Dana White is going to eliminate striking? Because what he really wants more than anything else is grappling in wrestling matches. Yeah, great. You don't want home runs. You actually want less home runs. Yeah, well, you got what you wanted last night because they didn't have much in the way of home runs. Or meaning, or action, or anything. In fact, by the 7th inning, it was pretty clear that those juice baseballs were not making a difference. So I was hoping that the commissioner would come out of his box and start personally injecting every single guy with Bolroids on the way to the batter's box. Hell, the game doesn't count, right? It's just for entertainment, right? Are we not entertained? No, we're not. But we want to be. Next time, let this guy shoot every player full of roids during BP and give us what we want. How boring was last night's game when the National League loaded the bases in the eighth inning with a chance to take or tie or take the lead? I was actually rooting for outs just to get the game over with. Now, there was a brief glimmer of hope and action, and honestly, at that point, I was just done. I didn't even want the action. At that point, I was practically coming off my couch, hitting my knees, begging for the game not to go into extra innings. The only thing worse than that baseball last night would have been more of that baseball last night. Extra innings. Free baseball. Normally, free is me. Unless it has anything to do with last night, then I'm reaching into my own pocket to make it go away. In fact, it seems like the only real action last night came before the game, not during the game, but before it, in a meeting between Justin Verlander, Joe Torre, Jim Leland, and at least one other official from Major League Baseball. You see, it would seem that those guys were not all that hyped on Verlander's comments about the balls being juiced and that it was a, quote, bleeping joke. And apparently, the old guys let him hear about it. According to Jason Stark, Verlander's teammate, Gerrit Cole, was the one who sent him in for that meeting. Quote, I may actually have facilitated that meeting. I saw Jim and Joe were in Alex Cora's office, and they said hi. Then Jim, in a not profanity-laden way, said, get Justin in here right now. So I came out and I said, hey, Skip wants to see you. And he said, okay. Then he comes back and he goes, man, I just got chewed out. End quote. Joe, Jimmy Smokes, unnamed MLB official. Maybe you should have had a conversation with everybody about making that game exciting last night, because that's the bigger issue here, right? I mean, come on. As my 14-year-old would say, actually? Come on, actually? That's what you're doing a couple of hours before the All-Star game. You're hustling down to the manager's office to call the starting pitcher in so you can rip him a new one. That's the most important thing in that moment. Look, I know you might be bent that a star pitcher and a future Hall of Famer was saying that the baseballs were juiced, but at least that got you the headlines. At least that was a baseball player making news, because last night's game sure wasn't. Like, Twitter's not the best gauge of interest, but there were more people getting worked up about Robert Redford in that meme than they were about the game itself. It's a clip of Redford nodding from nearly 50 years ago, and that was getting nearly as much run as the Midsummer Classic. That's a problem, yo. And by the way, way to handle that situation like pros, Joe, Jimmy Smokes, an unnamed MLB official. Verlander makes comments to Jeff Passan, and then a gang of old men from the league office come down to tell him to shut up. And if anything, that makes me believe that Verlander knew exactly what he was saying. It makes me believe him even more than I did before. Hey, again, I don't want to come down too hard on the game. I know I just lit it up. I know I just smashed it up. And I will balance that with a positive take a little bit later on. And I'm not here to hate. I don't hate baseball. I love baseball. I really do. I really do. If you listen to this show, you know how far back I go with the game. How much I care about the game. I do love baseball. Which is why last night disappointed me. Matthew Wolf is my guest. Matthew, great to have you on. Good morning. How are you?
Great. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Good, dude. Listen, you've had a couple of days for this to sink in. When you look back on Sunday and the back nine in particular, let me start right there. What kind of thoughts do you have?
Yeah, it was pretty hectic, obviously, because I knew I was up there by the lead, but Colin was starting to make a run, birdied, I think, 11, 12, 13, and was kind of bouncing back, and I knew that obviously Bryson and Wyndham Clark were up there by the lead as well, so definitely a little nerves kicked in, but just kept on sticking to my game plan and keeping calm out there.
Matthew Wolf joining us. So Matthew, what about the night before? On Saturday, you were tied for the lead, which made you the youngest player to ever have a 54-hole lead. The story goes that you received a text from one of your coaches at Oklahoma State. What was the text, and what did you take away from that text?
Yeah, it was Coach Starr at Oklahoma State, our assistant coach, and he kind of just told me, you know, winning on any level is the same. And I know how to win, I'm a born winner, and I know how to close it out and handle that pressure. And I was made for moments like those, or like the ones that I had in college. And you know, he kind of told me a little stat, which was funny, but gave me a lot of confidence. Is, you know, over the last, you know, 3-4 months, I've probably won more than any single person out there. You know, obviously it's in college and not the PGA Tour, but you know, I knew how to win. I knew how to close the deal, and you know, coming down the stretch, that was a definitely a little help to have in the back of my mind.
Listen, let me ask you something. Is there something that interferes with your happiness or is preventing you from achieving your goals? If so, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. BetterHelp offers licensed professional counselors who are specialized in issues such as depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, grief, self-esteem, and more. You can connect with your professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. Anything you share is confidential, and it's so very convenient. So right now, get help at your own time and at your own pace. You can schedule a secure video or phone sessions, plus chat and text with your therapist. And if for whatever reason you're not happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time and at no additional charge. Best of all, it is a truly affordable option. And if you're listening right now, you can get 10% off your first month with discount code Rome. So why not get started today? Go to BetterHelp.com/Rome. That's BetterHelp.com/Rome. And simply fill out a short questionnaire. And then get matched up with a counselor that you will love. BetterHelp.com/Rome. Once again, BetterHelp.com/Rome. We're talking to Matthew Wolf. Let me ask you this. I mean, you're locked in. You were locked in then. You're locked in right now. But is it true that you and your caddy were talking about NBA free agency during the round on Sunday? And if so, what kind of things were you guys talking about?
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about NBA free agency pretty much the entire week, to be honest. That was a pretty big headline, and with so many things going on, but it kind of took my mind off golf, which I really liked. I love focusing out there and, you know, competing and being in the moment, but you know, between shots, it's, you know, you're out there for 5 hours, 5+ hours, and you know, it's a lot to focus, and to be able to take your mind off of golf and relax a little bit, talk about a few other things. You know, it definitely helps me a lot. We kind of did that. We talked about a lot of other things, the free agency and a few others, just to, you know, keep my mind off of it and keep me relaxed out there.
We're talking to Matthew Wolf. Now, Bryson DeChambeau was playing ahead of you. He had that eagle on 18, which meant you were going to need a birdie to tie or an eagle to win. What was your mindset when you saw that?
Yeah, I was in the fairway holding the 5-iron that I was going to hit in a couple minutes, and I saw him make that putt for eagle, and you know, I knew I had to birdie, especially with Colin being in the fairway, but now I really needed a birdie, because, you know, to tie the lead, and the game plan was still the same, that we had a good line, you know, looking at the grandstands in the back, and a perfect club. So he kind of just told me to take a deep breath and trust my game. You know, he told me I was the best long iron player that week, which, you know, I feel like I really was. I was hitting my long irons very, very well, right where I wanted to, and the right distances, and I kind of just trusted it and didn't really cut as much as I wanted to, but left myself in a good spot.
Hey, Matthew, just to confirm, you're 20, right? You're 20, you're not 35 and 15 years on tour. You are 20, right?
Yes, sir, I'm 20.
All right, just confirming. Matthew Wolf, my guest. Listen, then you had that 26-foot putt for eagle on 18. What was going through you as you lined that up and then hit it?
Well, actually, I was just off the green, so I really couldn't line it up. But the biggest thing for me was, you know, I didn't make a lot of putts that day, and I knew I was putting good all week, so one of them was bound to drop. And, you know, me and Steve, my caddy, we picked a line, and both agreed on it very well. I knew the speed, and the biggest thing was just the contact, because the collar was right behind my ball, and just making sure to let it come out, you know, as on a true roll, and not, you know, do anything crazy with it. Just trust my read, trust my line, and trust myself. And I had the confidence to go up there and, you know, stay calm. And, you know, thankfully it went in. And like I said, my life has changed forever now.
Your life has changed forever now, but let's talk about something else. My favorite part of the conversation, in fact, if we go back, now you and I actually grew up much different times, but not that far apart. You're from Agoura Hills. Matthew, I don't know if you know, I grew up in Hidden Hills. I went to Calabasas High School. You went to Westlake. So we're from the same area, both 818. I've got to know, when did you first start to golf?
I first started to golf. I went to Lindero Country Club, like sports camp. And right around then, it was about probably 5 years old, and My dad used to take me to the range when I was like 4 or 5, and you know, since then I just loved it. And I played a bunch of other sports growing up. I played basketball and baseball and football for a year, soccer, but golf was just where my heart was at. I enjoyed it the most, and you know, kind of just loved being out on the course and hitting as far as I could, and just, you know, stuck with it, and thankfully it worked out pretty well.
Now, it worked out great. Now, what's really interesting is your swing instructor, George Gankis, said that he knew from the moment that he met you that you were something special. He also said that you were clowning him a little bit when you first met him. What do you remember about that first meeting? How old were you?
Yeah, I was 13 when I first met him. He practiced or taught at the same course that our high school practiced at, and I had a bunch of friends that were older that went to him, but I never really met him before. And you know, kind of like seeing him, and you know, I heard a lot about him, and the first time I talked to him, I said, "Are you George Gankis?" And kind of just, you know, not making fun of him, but you know, it was pretty cool to see him, you know, because I heard a lot about him before, and he, you know, he saw me swing, and he kind of, you know, asked me, like, he's like, "Are you joking, or is that your swing?" And I was like, "No, that's my swing," and he was like, that's the sickest thing I've ever seen, and from then, it's just history, you know, he loved it right away, didn't change it, and worked with it, and it was really cool to, you know, to see us progress over the years and how much success we both had.
I want to reiterate that point. I mean, your swing is different, and a lot of coaches might have been wanting to change that swing, but he loved it as soon as he saw it, and it's one of his favorite swings that he's ever seen. He said as much. So what did it mean to you that he was not looking to tinker or change that swing?
That's definitely something I was looking for from the start. Like I said, I feel really comfortable with my swing. It's a feel. It's not, I don't feel like I have to be in any position. If, you know, if no one ever recorded it, I feel like it'd be straight back, straight through. And, you know, to have that feeling is really important. And, I was kind of looking for someone who loved my swing and was going to work with it, not try to change it. And, you know, from the start, before I even asked him that, he told me how dope my swing was and just said, "I would love to work with you," and, you know, just kind of work with things in your swing and not change it at all. Let you do what you do, but just make it a little more consistent. And I loved hearing that right away, and really trusted him from that point on. And he's the only person I'll trust for my swing now.
Matthew Wolf, my guest. So what's your home course? What's your home club?
Well, right now I'm in the process of trying to join Medalist because I moved down to Jupiter, Medalist Golf Club. But growing up was just Westlake Golf Course. I was never fortunate enough to be a member anywhere in Southern California, especially, you know, growing up in the 818, how expensive it is and how nice of an area that is. You know, I was never, you know, I never had the ability to join anywhere. And I was, you know, brought up to Sherwood by a few of my friends every once in a while, but for the most part, it was just, you know, public courses around that area and, you know, to see where I came from. And in no way did I have it tough, but, you know, I wasn't as fortunate as some of the other golfers that I played junior golf with and in that area. So it was nice to be able to you know, come from that and improve myself, and now, you know, do my own, you know, have my own success and be able to join a place, and especially like Medalist, which is an unbelievable course.
It's an unbelievable place, and I understand why you're in Jupiter. There's a lot of guys there. There's a lot of reasons for you to be there. I hate to lose you there. Are you still going to claim the 818 is your own? Like, did you go to the Sagebrush Cantina? Tina, did you hang out at the Canyon Club? Did you ever get to the Commons? What were you doing in the 818 before you left for college?
Yeah, the 818 while I was being home. You know, Agoura Hills is where I grew up, and that's you know, it's always going to be where, you know, where I'm from. My mom still lives there. My brother is moving to San Francisco, but he still lives there right now too. And it's just, you know, that's where all my friends are still living, because they're still in college right now. So, you know, when they go back home, they go there. And it's cool to see where I've come. But you know, growing up there, we would go to the Canyon Club. We'd hang around there, and there'd be some things to do. But for the most part, I'd go over to my friend's house and just play video games and, you know, swim in the pool, especially with the good weather there. And, you know, it's a really cool place. And I lived there for the first 18 years of my life and still love it, but I'm really happy with, you know, going to OSU, to Stillwater. I love that place, and that's my second home, and now Jupiter is my third home. So all those places I really love, and I'm happy to call home.
Matthew Wolf, my guest, my man, you are living a great life, and you've earned it. You put in the time, you put in the work, and I'm glad to hear you still repping the 818. And again, as I mentioned, I understand why you are where you are right now and what a great thrill that was over the weekend. Dude, so good to have you on the show. Matthew, we got to do it again soon. I appreciate you, and really good to talk to you today. Thanks so much for that.
Of course, yeah. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Matthew Wolf, he's 20. There was one thing that saved that game last night. There was one thing that saved that night even. Shane Robert Bieber, your 2019 MLB All-Star MVP. What an absolute legend. Let's go back a little bit. Because when you're talking about Shane Bieber, you're talking about a guy who was a walk-on at UC Santa Barbara. Hell yes, he's a gaucho. Of course. If you didn't know that before, you knew it last night with the way he handled his business when he entered the game in the fifth. Here he is facing Wilson Contreras.
For Carrasco, tailing strike three.
Take a seat, meat. Next up, Ketel Marte.
3-2 pitch. Out in front of it, struck him out.
Hey, Marte, have some. Ronald Acuna Jr., how's this?
He struck him out.
Shane Robert Bieber, if you need him. And that game and that night absolutely did. He needed somebody to come in and take control, to seize the moment, to become a star, a boss, a legend. That's what Shane Bieber did. No walks, no hits, no nothing. Three up, three down. What a performance in front of his hometown fans who were going crazy and chanting, "Let's go, Bieber. Let's go, Bieber." As the MVP himself said afterwards, he didn't even really know what was going on.
Couldn't really feel my body that much because, like I said, the electricity and the atmosphere and we had going. And then, but also you didn't want to leave a cookie over the plate because these guys are so good and they'll take advantage of it. So really just tried to fill up the zone as much as I could and go out there and get three outs. That was the main agenda.
That was the main agenda. Agenda set. Mission accomplished. MVP won. As Francisco Lindor said, quote, "Shane Bieber, he showed them something today," end quote. Man, he sure as hell did. But then again, he always does. That's how we do it at UCSB. That's what gauchos do. You don't believe me? Ask Michael Young. You don't believe me? Ask Shane Bieber. And again, Bieber's not just a gaucho. Bieber was a walk-on. A walk-on at UCSB. How insane is this story? 5 years ago, he was worried that he might be cut from the UCSB baseball team. And now last night, 5 years later, he's picking up the MVP trophy for the All-Star game and the keys to a new rig. I mean, back then, when he thought he might not last at UCSB, he was throwing in the mid to high 80s. A couple of years later, he was the team's ace, leading them to Chomaha. Now he's the All-Star game MVP. Like that. And if that story weren't already amazing enough, this guy wasn't even on the All-Star team until Friday. Then he just shows up and dominates the way he did. Then again, the fact that he got an opportunity and absolutely crushed it should not surprise anybody at all. He made his MLB debut barely 13 months ago. He's already an All-Star. He's already an All-Star game MVP. Rock solid as a rookie last year. But coming into this year, he was not expected to carry that team. They were not asking him to do that. Then Corey Kluber and Mike Clevinger go down. Carlos Carrasco diagnosed with leukemia. And how emotional was that last night? And then all Bieber does is what he's always done. Step the hell up. Top 10 in the AL in innings. Strikeouts, whip, winning percentage. And on top of all that, All-Star Game MVP. And it's not just hard to win the All-Star Game MVP as a pitcher. It's damn near impossible, especially as a reliever. I mean, of course, you're barely in the game. Here is a list of the pitchers who have been named All-Star Game MVP in the past 30 years. Pedro Martinez, Mariano Rivera, Shane Bieber. That's it. That's your list. Three of the absolute best to ever do it. Pedro Martinez, Mariano Rivera, and Shane Bieber. Three of the best to ever do it. And I'm going to tell you, not necessarily in that order either, if you're asking me. So how'd it feel to win the MVP award, my man, and to be grouped with those other two legends?
I didn't really know what to think. Kind of lost all feeling in my body, but it's... It's an incredible feeling now that it's kind of sinking in. just to be able to do it in front of the home crowd in my first All-Star game is definitely not something I expected.
Well, I expected it. I expected it. The entire Gaucho Nation expected it. Game recognizes game. Gaucho recognizes Gaucho. Shane bleeping Bieber. A bleeping legend. I could not be more proud of you, brother. You know that thing about me not rooting for anybody or anything other than something to talk about? Still true. Still true. Unless it involves a UC Santa Barbara Gaucho, then I'm all in. In fact, my only regret is that I did not lead the show with it. I should have. I should have started with something positive. I should have started with the good story, not the negative story. I should have. That's my regret. Way to rep the Gaucho Nation, Shane. My man, I try to keep some separation between myself and the guys and gals that I talk about on the program. I need to be objective. I don't want anybody to question my loyalty or my objectivity. That said, pitcher's on me. It's Sam's to go, bro. War DP. War FT, 2 North. Wore the 6,500 block of Sabado. Wore the countdown at the old nightclub, The Graduate. Wore my sweet mate at DP, Greg Holcomb. What up, Holcomb? That's a good kid. I love that guy. And wore the greatest university in all of the land, UC Santa Barbara. Way to show out, Gaucho. Man, I'm proud of that guy. Of course, I'm speaking of Rick Carlisle. Rick, it's good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, it's been too long. Great to be back in the jungle.
It has been too long. Great to have you back, Rick. Now, before we get into the work and your offseason, last month you were at a Basketball Without Borders camp in Latvia. Let me start right there. What was that experience like for you?
Well, it was great because I spent 2 days in a town called Liepāja, which is a coastal town on the Baltic Sea where Kristaps Porzingis is from, and we spent 2 days there. I was observing and talking to kids at his camp. He's got a camp for 13, 14, and 15-year-old kids that are learning the game, trying to get off to a good start, et cetera. And then from there, we went up to Riga and went to Basketball Without Borders and had a great experience with the NBA up there. Riga is a fantastic town. The weather was great. It was like being in San Diego, Jim.
That's cool. Now, the NBA, Rick, obviously is focused on growing the game internationally and has been for quite some time. As somebody who's been around the league as long as you have, what's it like for you to see the growth of the game overseas?
Well, it's amazing. And, you know, the impact that we have abroad is obviously massive. But the impact that the international game has had on our game has been massive too. You know, 20 years ago, the European leagues, all the international leagues, they were getting ahead of us in skill development, and a lot of those kinds of things. And you know, 20 years ago, I was an assistant in Portland when Arvydas Sabonis came over. A little longer than that ago, I was an assistant in New Jersey when Drazen Petrovic joined us for a couple of years. And so, you know, I've seen firsthand the influx of some of their great, the all-time great European players and what that has meant to our league. And those guys had tremendous impact. Of course, you know, Petrovic's story is tragic as he was killed in a car accident, you know, 2 years into his career. But the other thing I can tell you is that we were in China this past fall for two exhibition games, and the interest in the NBA in China is almost impossible to believe. We were in Shanghai and Shenzhen, and you know, the crowds of people, the masses of people, and the interest in the NBA, it was just off the charts.
Rick Carlisle joins us. You know, Rick, you mentioned Drazen Petrovic, and his passing was so sad. He was beloved. Can you remember what was it like? What went through your mind the first time you saw him play, and what was it like to be around him?
Well, the first time I saw him play, he was a role player, bench player with the Portland Trailblazers. And, you know, they were still on that run of the late 80s, early 90s of getting to a couple of finals and stuff like that. And he wasn't playing very much. And so, you know, we were able to acquire him in a multi-team trade when I was with the Nets, and we were in a rebuild at that time when I was an assistant. He immediately became a starter for us. And his first year, his numbers bumped up significantly because he was playing more. And, you know, we didn't have much scoring, so we were running the ball through his hands a lot. And then the second year, he was even better. And he was third team all NBA before the tragic accident happened. So, you know, his career trajectory was headed toward becoming an NBA All-Star. And, you know, yeah, he was already one of the all-time great European players and European, I should say, slash international players. But, you know, his future at that point in time looked limitless.
Dallas Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle joining us. I appreciate your thoughts on him. Now, Rick, one of the absolute icons of international basketball is somebody you, of course, know very well. I'm speaking of Dirk, a guy so legendary, he only needs one name. This coming season is going to be your first without him. What's it going to be like to coach without Dirk there?
Well, Jim, it's a very good question. He has been such a consistent force just day to day, always in early, always doing everything from a professional standpoint to prepare himself to practice, to play, everything else. I mean, you know, I was real fortunate. I got to coach Reggie Miller, both in his prime and at the end of his career, and Dirk. And you know, it's been 11 straight years I've been with Dirk. And, you know, when a franchise player leaves a franchise, as Reggie did in 2005 and Dirk's doing now, you know, you're not exactly sure how it's going to affect things. You know, the year Reggie retired, we were headed into a year where there was great expectation in Indiana. And then, you know, things just kind of short-circuited and it just didn't go the way everybody had hoped it would. And a lot of it, I felt, was because of the loss of that consistency on a day-to-day basis with a guy like Reggie. And so now, you know, we've got the same situation with Dirk. I'm older and wiser, having been through that. We're preparing ourselves for, you know, life without Dirk and what that means. And we're really working hard to prepare our younger guys to become the same kind of leaders that he was. But it's a very big task and a very big responsibility, and, you know, those things don't happen overnight.
No, that's an enormous task and responsibility and a big ask of the young guys. Rick Carlisle joining us. Rick, in terms of the young guys, we're now just a year removed from the team making that move to draft Luka Doncic, and you're not going to make that move without having high expectations. You know, I'm curious, the transition to the NBA, whether it's from college or the international game, is always going to be tricky. What do you make of how he handled it last year?
Well, he handled it extremely well, but his situation was unique. You know, he's been a professional player since age 15 or 16, and you know, he'd been around guys that were crafty, veteran, you know, great international players. He'd learned a lot of the tricks of the trade, and as time went on, he played more and more and more, which culminated, you know, in the spring of 18, he was the best player on his team that won. You know, I think they won the Euro League, and they won two of the European championships, and he was MVP of both leagues and both championships. And so at that point in time, you know, for a kid that age, he had achieved more than anybody had ever achieved at that age in Europe, you know, more than Ginobili, more than Petrovic, you know, any of these guys, just in terms of, you know, being decorated. You know, and that experience really helped him because, you know, he was a professional player when he walked in the door. He had that experience. And not only had he just been a pro for 4 or 5 years, you know, he had played in a lot of really important national team games. You know, the Slovenia in 2017 won the Eurobasket. You know, it was a huge upset, you know, and he and Dragic were the key guys on that team. And those games, Jim, I mean, you know, are so pressure packed with so much national pride on the line and everything else. You know, the kids in the United States, many of them don't have the opportunity to have those kinds of experiences. And you go from that, you know, to what he did in 18 and then, you know, right onto our roster. He was more prepared than most.
Talking to Dallas Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle, and then now you've got a possibility to recompare him with Porzingis. And you mentioned, Rick, Porzingis a few moments ago. He's recovering from that ACL injury, so you haven't had the chance to play him in games yet, and I know you're getting to know him. What's that process been like for you, and how's he looked to you physically?
Well, the process has been great. You know, I got to know him a little bit a couple of summers ago at one of the camps that he and I were both at. At that time, he had asked, you know, about the possibility of getting together with Dirk to work out or, you know, spend some time with him and stuff. And I think this was after his second year in New York. And they had tried to get together, you know, previously to that time. And so, you know, I talked to Dirk about it, and they could never quite get it together. But he always was a guy that had tremendous respect for Dirk. So I got to know him a little bit then. And then, you know, after the trade, that little bit of familiarity that we had was very helpful. You know, at that point, mid-February, Jim, you know, he was very much on his way to a full recovery in terms of where he was with the knee and his body and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, the last 3 weeks of the season, he was participating in live 5-on-5 scrimmages and practices. It had been decided before he was traded us that he was not going to play in any games this year. And so, you know, things look great. You know, he's a kid that's even though he's only 23 years old, he's been a professional, much like Luka. He's been in a tough media market in New York. And I think he's going to be very motivated to try to win some games with us.
Mavericks head coach Rick Carlisle joining us back in the jungle for a few more moments. Now, Rick, I had your former assistant Terry Stotts on the program yesterday, and I routinely talk to another one of your assistants from that 2011 team, Dwayne Casey. How much pride do you take in the success that they've had as head coaches after their time with you in Dallas?
Well, it's one of the greatest things, you know, if you can be in this business, help guys get head jobs, and then see them have that kind of success. You know, a lot of teams passed on Dwayne Casey for a long time, and then you know, the Toronto Raptors, you know, after we won the championship in 2011, you know, that night in Miami, about 5 minutes after the game, I picked up my cell phone. I called Brian Colangelo in Toronto. They were in the midst of a coaching search. I said, "Brian, I got your guy here." And so, you know, and within about 2 weeks, he had gone through the process and he had become the Raptors coach. And then, you know, he oversaw that rebuild for a great portion of it, had a lot of success over 7 years, and then went on to Detroit and got another big deal. So that was great. And then what Terry's done in Portland, Jim, has been, you know, just amazing. You know, he took a job in the summer of 2012 that nobody wanted. There were a couple of veteran coaches that just flat out turned it down without even, you know, without even interviewing. They just didn't think the team was that good, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that was the summer when Lillard got drafted. And so Stotts has taken Lillard and then McCollum, and some of these other guys, and molded these guys into, you know, a true contending team. He just got an extension, so he'll be there for another 3 years, 3 or 4 years at least. That'll take him over 10 years. And, you know, and those two guys, not coincidentally, had great impact on our 2011 championship team. So a lot of pride there for sure.
Rick Carlisle, my guest. Rick, before I let you go, one more guy I've got to ask you about. No way we run down a list of guys that have been with you and are now head coaches without talking about Jerry Stackhouse. Stack's always been one of my favorites. Now, this is a guy who did really well for himself financially during his time as a player. He doesn't need to work. What's it say about him then that he wanted to grind it out as an assistant and a coach in the G League in order to become a head coach? And then how do you think he'll do at Vanderbilt?
Well, he'll do great. You know, he's a guy, you know, Jim, who has an iron will. And, you know, interesting that, you know, he interviewed for a couple of NBA head jobs. It, you know, the process wasn't going along as quickly as he had hoped. And so he just pivoted. He had a relationship with Malcolm Turner, who had taken over at Vanderbilt, and decided to go get some head coaching experience there. And, you know Stack, he's a man who is strong-willed. He sees things the way he sees them. And I have great respect for the fact that he decided to jump into the best situation where he could become a head coach the soonest, because in our profession, Jim, you learn the most by being a head coach, by being the guy that has responsibility for everything, for the players, for your staff, for dealing with ownership or your athletic director, your marketing people, your PR people, your sports information director, whatever it is. He'll grow tremendously there. And, I expect he's going to be an NBA head coach at some point.
He was an NBA champion as a player and a head coach. Third among active coaches in wins. Rick, you said it best. It had been far too long since I had you in the jungle, but great to run you down. I really appreciate you in that conversation. As always, Rick, thank you so much. That was great.
Okay, Jim. Take care.
We're talking to Andrew Checkitz. He had Shane Bieber in college. Andrew, good to have you back. How are you?
Good, Jim. Thanks for having me on.
Always good to have you on, Checks. All right, so what was it like for you when you first heard that Shane Bieber had been selected to play in the All-Star game in Cleveland?
Pretty amazing. I mean, his last 6 years have been really amazing for him. Obviously, we'll take the great publicity, but, he went from a walk-on to starting rotation to, an all-conference player to going to the College World Series, to a good draft, to the big leagues, to an all-star, and has had a tremendous amount of upward trajectory.
You know, I want to talk about those 6 years in a minute, but when he comes in last night and the crowd is going wild, he strikes out the side, which is obviously very rare in an all-star game. What did you make of his performance?
I'm continually impressed with his stuff and just how much better it's gotten. Every single year that he pitches, when he left us, it was, 88 to 92. He'd flash a 93, and the secondary stuff was decent, but not like the stuff that he's rolling out there now, the breaking ball, and he's getting flinches out of real hitters, and the fastball, 95 down, and the ability to throw up. So I just, every time I watch him, I'm impressed with how much better he's gotten. And he's always had the poise part of it. I mean, that piece of it, and the strike throwing piece of it. When he got here, he was somebody that you could blindfold and spin around three times and he'd still throw a strike.
That's a great line. I love that quote. So is that something that you can coach, or is that something that's just natural?
I mean, we all think that we can coach it a little bit, but I think by the time that they get to us in terms of having that elite command, I think, they've got feel and they've picked that up along the way. We feel like we can make guys better and, take them from B to A or C to B, but it's hard to take a guy that doesn't have feel and doesn't have command and all of a sudden make him an elite strike thrower like Shane.
UCSB head coach Andrew Checkitz is joining us right now. You mentioned what it was like when he got to campus. What about his stuff? I mean, the story goes that he was throwing in the mid to high 80s and he had something of a lollipop curveball. What did you see in him when he came on campus that made you think this guy may be something?
Well, we saw him early, and I mean, there's a piece of it. He was a walk-on, but it wasn't like we didn't know who he was. I mean, he'd come on campus before, and we were low on scholarship at that point, and scholarship money at that point, and he didn't have a ton of velocity and stuff, but he had the command, he had the feel, and then when we got him here, I saw him this summer right before he showed up on campus, and was pretty excited about it just because of his ability to compete and throw strikes and throw the ball in the strike zone. He had a projectable frame. He just kept getting better and better and better and putting on weight, and the velocity crept up. And, his first year, there weren't a lot of breaking balls. I remember he had a really good outing at Cal Poly, and he was warming up before the game, and the breaking ball wasn't very good. And I said, hey, you can do it with all fastballs today, and he did. I think he threw two off-speed pitches. Ended up having a great outing that day. So, command plays and plays at our level, and, the stuff kept getting better and better and better.
We're talking to Andrew Checkitz. He had Shane Bieber in college. Part of the story is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but part of his story seems to be that back in 2014, over winter break, he thought he might not make the team, but he not only makes the team, he ends up as a serious contributor as a freshman, and then he was the ace when he went to Omaha a couple of years later. I mean, what does that say about his growth and his work ethic?
Yeah, he's a tremendous worker. I think for Shane, someone was asking me last night, how do you describe him? And I don't think I did a great job with last night, but I thought about it overnight. He's grounded. He's really grounded. He knows where he came from. He's a worker. He's trying to get better. He was here in the off season, training and working and trying to get better. And I think that's why you see the continual improvement. And obviously, he's been fortunate. He's got some skills, and he's been that command piece of it is something that sometimes guys get that 97 mile an hour arm, and sometimes guys get that elite feel, and he's got the elite feel.
Now, not only did he win the award last night, but he did so while wearing cleats that had Santa Barbara to Cleveland written on them. Personally, I mean, it gave me chills. But what's that mean to you and the program to see that?
I mean, he's flying the flag for us, and I think he's really done a nice job of representing us on the field and off the field. It does mean a lot. My phone was blowing up last night, and everybody was really excited about it. And how he's handled himself in the clubhouse and with the media, it's been impressive.
Hey, listen, Andrew, what's that mean, though? When you're recruiting guys to UCSB, how valuable is it to have a story like Shane Bieber to point to and say, this is the kind of thing that can happen? I mean, he's a special guy, but this is the kind of thing that can happen here.
Yeah, we try to hang our hats on the development piece of it and on guys getting better and improving. And, Shane's obviously the best example of that right now, but we've had some other guys like Dylan Tate, who was the first pitcher taken in the draft in 2015. And I don't know the exact number, but to toot our own horn, I think we've had, we're either tied or the most players drafted on the West Coast in the last 5 years. So we're hanging our hats on the development piece of it. And the school part of it and the academic piece of it and the location piece of it. But when we're sitting down with families, we're really talking about, if you come here, we think we can help you get better.
I know it. We're talking to UCSB head baseball coach Andrew Cheketz for a couple of more moments. Now, you're coming off a season where you led the team to a program record 45 wins against D1 opponents. You had 13 players named to the All-Big West team. I know the year did not end the way you would have hoped, but looking back, how special was the season?
It was remarkable. We had three win streaks of 12 wins or better. We broke the school records for consecutive wins, and the kids really did an amazing job. I mean, it was just, we found ways to win. They kept finding ways to win. The days that we didn't pitch, we hit. And the days that we didn't hit, we pitched. And it was a really great group to coach. And obviously, it did not end the way that we had all hoped. But, a lot of really special things happened. And those kids really hung it out there.
Hey, listen, I steered clear of you during the process, but I do have to ask you, because of the success you've had there, your name has come up for other jobs, one that might arguably be considered bigger jobs, but you decide to stay at UC Santa Barbara. What did that come down to? What was that process like?
Well, I had somebody ask me that the other day just about, what if your dream job comes up? And I said, well, I have my dream job. This, in terms of the location, the weather, I like coaching shorts and a T-shirt every day. It's 70 degrees. Every day we've got proximity to players. We've got a great package to recruit to with the academics and the baseball piece of it. And, the other piece for me is my family and I walk to work and my kids go to Isla Vista Elementary and I get a lot of opportunities to see them here. And so I think it's a great place to raise a family and we've really, really enjoyed our time here. And, I think the thoughts of leaving Santa Barbara and moving our family are just, it's really, really challenging to think about that. And we've had great support from our administration and feel like we're building and got lights going in right now. And we've been working hard on that. So really excited about the future and want to continue to build here.
Glad to hear the lights are coming in finally. He is the head baseball coach at UC Santa Barbara. He was named coach in 2011. I see you working, Coach. Led UCSB to their first College World Series appearance in 2016 and coached All-Star Game MVP Shane Bieber at UCSB. Andrew, great to have you back. Really appreciate the conversation. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jim. Go Chos.
We are joined by Glover Quinn. Glover, it's good to have you back. How are you?
All right, man. How you doing?
Good, good. So you announced your retirement yesterday, as I mentioned, and from the outside, it sure seemed like you could have kept playing and been a really valuable part of the team. So what made you feel like now was a good time to retire?
I played 10, and that was the the original goal for me, to play 10 and to be able to leave the game healthy. That's what I wanted to do. I got three young boys, and so I felt like if I could still play in the NFL, then I could definitely play with my kids, and I could run around, and I could be an integral part of their life. So when I walked off the field after that last game in Green Bay, I was healthy. I didn't need any surgeries. I actually wasn't even on the injury report the whole season, so I was feeling really good. So I knew it would take a great situation, you know, for me to even get back on the field, and, you know, that situation never came. And so I was like, hey, I'm good. I'm happy. I'm ready to move on.
Makes sense. Now, when you talk about the fact that you didn't need surgery, the fact is it's not just 10 years of being in the league. It's not just 10 years of hanging on. You started every single game for the last 9 seasons. And at the end of last year, you had a great line. You said, quote, "My body loves me and I love it back," end of quote. As you know, availability is the best ability. So how did you go about preparing to make sure that your body was ready to go every single time? And how important was it then for you to have your teammates know that they could count on you to be out there every single week?
Well, training, you know, training was a huge part of it. Obviously, I was blessed by God to be healthy, to have the mentality that I had to work at it. But training, eating right, staying off the alcohol, stretching, massages, all those things. And, you know, it got to the point to where, like you said, I took pride in wanting my teammates to know that each and every Sunday that we strap it up, that I was going to be there. So sacrifices, discipline, all those things that, you know, it takes to obviously do this for a long period of time, I've done it. And, you know, it's very fulfilling to me to be able to look back and see that, man, out of 160 possible regular season games, I played in 159 of them, and I missed one, you know, my rookie year. So for me, that's what I wanted. I wanted to get their respect from my teammates, from my peers, and you know, it worked out perfect.
Glover Quinn is joining us. He just announced his retirement. One of the things you've also said is that, quote, "Football was never who I was as a person. It was always what I had done. I wanted to use football as a stepping stone into the rest of my life and not let football be my life," end quote. Now, to me, that's a really powerful statement, because a lot of guys truly struggle with their identity after they leave the game. So what do you think your life's going to be like without football?
Man, you know, I don't know exactly what it's gonna be like, you know, without football. I do know I have a beautiful family. I got three amazing kids, a beautiful wife. Definitely want to give them a lot of time and attention and support in whatever they're doing. And for me, it's just, I wanted to put myself in a position to be able to do the things that I passionately want to do when I was done playing, instead of things that I felt like I had to do. I feel like so many people leave the game and they're in, you know, all types of different situations. And they just kind of feel like, you know, I have to take this job, or I have to, you know, take this, or I have to do that. And, you know, me, I want to be in a position to be able to say, you know what, I don't really have to do anything. This is something that I want to do. This is something that I'm passionate about. This is something that fulfills, you know, a lot of things for me, for other people. And so that's what I'm looking most forward to, is to see, you know, what that leads me to, and, you know, and see how it plays out.
I think that's really profound, that you want to be able to do things that you're passionate about as opposed to things that you have to do, like most people. And in large part, that's how you set that up. Now, you and I have talked about your financial approach in the past, something that goes back to your time at New Mexico and your connection to my guy, Humble, who has done an amazing job for a lot of people. Now that you are retired, how do you go about approaching your finances and your business interests? What will your process be now?
I think, you know, my finances, I mean, for us, you know, we've kind of developed a lifestyle that you know, we can live off of and be good for a really, really long time. I think some of the companies that I'm invested in and things like that, I think, you know, I have a little more time to devote more time to that, you know, helping marketing processes and things like that to kind of, you know, help some of those companies. But I think, you know, it'll always be a team approach, you know. Obviously, my wife and I, Humble is a huge part of the team. Just the people around us making good decisions, you know, looking at the pros and the cons and saying things that I want to get involved in, things that I want to represent, things that I don't, and just go from there. You know, I'm not rushing into anything right now. I'm honestly just enjoying the feeling, you know, of being in July and not having to train for a training camp, not having to prepare my brain to go out and play 16 games and be there every day at a high level. I've actually never experienced that for a really long time. You know, ever since, you know, high school, you're getting ready to play in August. You know, July, you're getting ready. Go to college, you're going through training right now, getting ready for the season. So to be at a point to where mentally I don't have that, you know, on my brain and on my shoulders, it's a great feeling. So I'm just kind of relaxing right now and seeing what happens.
Glover Quinn joining us. You know, I bet it feels great right now. I'm sure it feels great right now. I wonder, do you think it's going to feel different when the fall rolls around? And do you think there's going to be any part of you that is tempted to put the pads back on? Do you think you might get the itch to play again in the fall?
I don't think I will. And that was all part of the plan. You know, that's why I've done the things that I've done, and I wanted to be there each and every day. People see the games. You know, that I didn't miss games. I mean, you can look at the injury reports. I very rarely even miss practice. You know, I wanted to play every day. I wanted to practice every day. I wanted to play in every game. I wanted to do everything that I could so that I didn't have any regrets. So that when I walked away, I didn't feel like, man, I wish I could get one of those years back. You know, you know what? I'm going to go play another year, just, you know, whatever. Like, I didn't want that. I wanted to give it everything that I had, put everything I could into it. And when it was time for me to walk away, I wanted to walk away in peace. And I feel extremely at peace with my decision. I don't feel like I know some guys who leave and they're just like, you know, they don't want to even watch football anymore because they feel like they still want to play and they didn't get the opportunity, or they said that they leave the game with regret, or they leave the game with anger because of whatever. I mean, I feel good. I feel like I can watch games. I can go to training camps. I feel good about it. I don't have any regrets. And, you know, I don't have any desire to go back out there and play. I feel like I've done my time, and, you know, I was ready to move on.
You know what we're talking about leaving the game on your own terms. And I think every athlete that I've ever spoken to wants to leave the game on their own terms, and so few are able to do it. And I think one of the reasons you were is because of what we're talking about. I mean, you've had this process, the way you see things, the way you think about things. I mean, you're kind of a sage like that. You're very wise, years beyond your age. My question is, yeah, I mean, you talk like somebody who is much older, and some people never even get to this spot. Where did this thought process come from and this approach? Did somebody kind of point this out, show it to you, or did you come to this on your own?
Oh, man, I don't know. I mean, I got great parents, wonderful parents, mom, dad, you know, great family. You know, I think just for me, I was chosen to be something different for my family, to, you know, bring a different approach. And, you know, I just took it in stride. I've very, you know, Coach Caldwell used to say all the time, any fool can learn from his own mistakes. It takes a very wise man to learn from the mistakes of others. And so thinking back over my life and just the things that, you know, I've went through, I was very good at seeing what other people did and not wanting to do that. Seeing the life that certain people lived and saying, okay, well, these are some of the decisions that they made, and this is how they have to live. Okay, I don't want to do that. I want to do it this way. But I've been like that my whole life. I was born that way, and just as I grew, you know, I wasn't afraid to step out. You know, I left Mississippi and went all the way to Albuquerque, New Mexico to play college football because I told my mom I wanted to play Division I football. I wasn't afraid to leave. I wasn't afraid to take those steps and you know, try to do something different with my life than a lot of other people that I had seen growing up. And so I don't know. I just, over the years, the different experiences, just, you know, using my head to think about things, to make sure I'm trying to make the best decision, just kind of grew into it. I don't know. It just happened.
Glover Quinn joining us. I love the response, actually. You know, I had a number of stories that I was going to ask you about from teammates talking about what you meant to them and that they would not be where they are without you. Quandre Diggs was telling a story to ESPN last year that he might not even be a good safety in the league had he not been able to watch you and emulate you. Don Carey was telling stories, too. My point is, the NFL can be so cutthroat. It can be such a brutal business. A lot of guys do not want to show other guys the ropes or help them out, but that was something that was important to you. How come?
I don't know. That's just the way I've always been. I've always been that type of way, and I don't know. I never felt like I had to, you know, keep things from other people to continue to play. I felt like, you know, I was going to handle my business. I was going to do things the right way. I was going to play at a high level. But I also felt like it was important for me to bring my teammates and guys along with me, because at the end of the day, we all need each other to win and be successful. So I felt like my career and the things that I went through, I was able to reach a lot of different people because I came in as a corner, as a fourth rounder. I wasn't a first round draft pick. I wasn't an undrafted guy. So I was kind of in the middle. I was a corner, played 2 years as a corner and a nickel. Then I moved to safety, played the dime. So I had played basically every position in the secondary. So I knew how all those different things worked together. I knew how it felt. So, you know, for different guys, for Quandre, for Don Carey, for just all these different guys, I mean, I knew the things that they were dealing with. I knew the things they were feeling. I knew you know, how to help them from the things that I had to learn, because when I first came in the league, you know, I didn't really have somebody to like take me under their wing. It was kind of like I had to figure out how to do things all on my own. My rookie year, you know, that was 2009 in Houston. Dante Robinson was a great player, but my rookie year, he was going through his contract dispute with the Texans. So he wasn't there for the off-season program. He wasn't there for training camp. You know, that was the year that, you know, the first game, I think he had to pay me Rick on the back of his shoes. So he was in that phase of his career where he was trying to get paid, and, you know, and I understood that. But he wasn't trying to take me as a young guy under his wing. So I watched his situation. I watched all those things. And, you know, the next year, he was gone. And we drafted Kareem Jackson as a first rounder, and I was the oldest corner on the team as a second year player. And you know, those guys were looking at me to try to lead the way, and I'm sitting here like, bro, I'm a fourth rounder trying to survive in the league.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I'm still trying to survive, but I had to help the younger guys, and you know, I just felt like, you know, that approach to, you know, just feeling like, hey, I don't have a problem helping people, telling people the things that I've learned, and just going at it, you know, it helped me gain a lot of respect from my teammates, a lot of respect from my peers and things like that. And it helped me. It pushed me to continue to work hard to be the best that I could be so that I could continue to play, because I had to be able to show them some of the things that I was telling them. So it all worked out.
Glover Quinn joining us. You know, this is one of those things, before you go, I got to ask. And you know, somebody in my position will ask this question of somebody who retired. It seems like a throwaway, but knowing you and the respect I have for you, I really am curious. What are you going to miss most about it once you walk away?
Oh, man. What am I going to miss most about it? I think, you know, everybody says, you know, the locker room. I think for me, the thing that I miss probably the most is, you know, playing the game. You know, I loved playing the game. I have great friends that I'm sure I'll continue to talk to, continue to be, you know, a part of their lives. You know, the locker room was great. Bunch of stories. But I think for me, just playing the game, you know, just running out of that tunnel, hearing fans cheer for you, hearing fans boo you. Like, I mean, those are great feelings, man. Great moments, things that, you know, I definitely cherish. But that's probably the biggest thing for me, just actually Sundays and Monday nights and Thursdays, just actually playing the game, probably be the biggest thing for me.
Listen, I would say to you, man, I'm going to miss these conversations, but whether you like it or not, I will continue to look for you even in retirement, so we'll have more of these conversations.
Oh, yeah.
Good night now!